Welcome to Supply Chain Next with your host, Richard Donaldson. Join us as we explore the ongoing evolution of supply chain, from the challenges professionals face every day to the ongoing digital transformation of the entire value network.
Without further ado, Mr. Peter Evans, welcome to Supply Chain Next. Just as you and I are briefly chatting beforehand here, I am both embarrassed and shocked to not realize you haven't been on the show before, given all the things we've been talking about over the last year. So it's just really a pleasure to have you here.
Well, it's a great pleasure to be with you. So I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Yeah, I have been too. And like I said, you guys have been speaking quite a bit about certainly everything in the circular marketplaces and development here. But like we always want to do, and given the fact that it's your first time here, we'd love for you to just give a brief intro on kind of who you are and kind of how you got to this place over the past few decades.
Sure, sure. So my name is Peter Evans. I live in Denver, Colorado, and I lead the strategy practice at a company called McFadden Digital, which specializes in helping firms with their marketplace and platform strategy, technology assessment, and then we also do implementations. We are technology agnostic, so we're really here to help companies decipher what is the best technology to help them build and operate marketplaces. And we do very large engagements with Fortune 500 companies, as well as smaller companies that are just starting out and trying to launch marketplaces. So the full range and across multiple sectors. So I've done projects in retail, pharma, oil and gas. So it runs a full range. So it's pretty eclectic and diverse.
Yep. And that's, so go back a little bit further for me though, because I mean, you and I crossed paths years ago with Platform Revolution, and you were, you know, contributing to that, right? And I had Jeff Parker on a long time ago, and that's how you and I kind of connected originally. But I'm curious as to kind of your path that brought you here to circular platforms, right? I mean, it's not, a lot of times people don't start off their careers thinking they're going to be, you know, in the world of circularity. In fact, no one does that I'm aware of. Circularity wasn't even a concept when you and I are both in school. But just kind of chart, navigate through that a little bit. Like you've been an academic, but you've written quite a bit and you've led a lot of different things that are super interesting. But even how you got into platforms and how platforms is morphed now.
Sure. So I have an academic bent. I did, you know, my master's and my PhD at MIT. Mm-hmm. And then afterwards, I went and led strategy for GE's energy business. And I did more long-term market assessments. So my team was responsible for modeling power and gas sectors and watching global trends. And GE had a very broad portfolio. So we did oil, gas, and power. And so it required a very broad perspective on what was happening. And it essentially what that role was is corporate foresight. So some people call it seeing around corners, and helping the executives see things that they wouldn't otherwise. So, mm-hmm. You know, one example was I actually brought fracking to that company. They didn't know about it. Yeah, it seems.
Oh my God.
Yeah. So.
Okay, I just want to stop for a second there. Like, what in God's name was going on that you had to bring fracking to their attention at that point? So this has got to be in what, the 90s?
Oh, no. It was later. You know, I think some in the oil and gas industry, and going back, you know, I did consulting for Cambridge Energy Research Associates. So I was going to CERAWeek, and, you know, there was beginning to be rumblings of, wow, this is going to scale, right? People knew about fracking for a while, but I think the real insight or the impact that kind of dawned on people in 2005, 6, and 7 was really, really when it took off, is that this is going to take off and really scale. And equipment manufacturers, you know, they're busy on the upstream supply, serving customers in the traditional spaces. And this was a new space that they weren't paying attention to. So so that's kind of one. Anyway, so going back to your original question is, so it was this, basically, it was my responsibility to come up with and see things that they weren't seeing on a daily basis. And at my work, I spent quite a number of years at GE, and I came up with frameworks for thinking about the future. And one of them is what I call megatrends, shocks, constraints, and enablers, which is different from what you see typically in strategy frameworks, which is often SWOT analysis or horizons analysis. There's a number of different frameworks that are used. But this was, if you recall, way back, the Black Swans.
Sure.
That was very popular. So one of the things that I found in many marketing frameworks is there's no shock.
Mm-hmm.
Shocks are very difficult. They're episodic. And so it's very hard to plan for them. And so they don't have them in their frameworks. So I wanted to add shocks. Obviously, megatrends are done, and that's important to understand the underlying drivers, you know, big trends. But you got to go beyond that. So you have your megatrends, shocks, and then you have your constraints. And constraints are really interesting because they can come in many different ways. You can have basically have financial constraints. You can have talent constraints. You can have organizational constraints, right? You can have cultural issues in your company that make it difficult to innovate, for example. So that would be a constraint. And then, you know, and this is where a lot of, you know, the consulting firms every year put out their technology trends report. These are what I call enablers, right? These are new things that are coming down the pike. And right now the hot one is AI,
mm-hmm.
right? So that's going to be a new enabler. It's going to allow us to do new things. So I've always kept that framework in mind. And last year, as I was putting together the MIT Platform Strategy Summit with Jeff Parker and Marshall Van Alstyne, who you mentioned, we co-chair that conference together. You know, I really wanted to think about the future of platforms. The previous year, we had looked at the history of platforms. They've been around now for a decade or more. And so we had done a retrospective the previous year on kind of the growth and scale and the transition from these being kind of, you know, the new darlings. We remember when Airbnb first arrived, it was this novel thing and everybody was super excited about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Uber and all of these, to now a period in which people kind of are calling them gatekeepers and, you know, they're dominating markets. It's kind of interesting to see that transition. So instead of kind of looking to the past, I wanted to look at the future. And so I started looking at kind of what are the big mega trends. Going back to that framework that I just mentioned. And I was like, wow, you know, people are starting to talk about circularity. And then, you know, because I've been in this platform space for a long time, I was like, wow, you know what? There's actually very, very little work done by platform scholars on circular. So here immediately I saw a gap. You see a lot of attention to circularity on one hand, but absolutely no attention to platforms amongst that community. And then you have this other community that has done a deep dive and has done really impressive work on understanding the dynamics of platforms, but they don't speak to anything related to circularity. So I was like, wow, here's a perfect thing. So I put together a panel and I started thinking about this and came up with this conceptual framework of distinguishing linear platforms or marketplaces from circular platforms and marketplaces. And then I started looking around and I've started building a database of platforms, and I've actually found quite a number of them. We can talk more about kind of the research that I've been doing recently to uncover.
Absolutely. I mean, again, 115 firms, and now we're going to get to that, get to the report that you just authored and that context that's going to come up here. But before we get off the platforms, what made you begin to see, because you're a futurist. Clearly, you're someone that's looking at trends. You're even working at GE to look around the corners, as you put it, right? You're, and you're looking for patterns, hence frameworks. I mean, these are all synonyms for different patterns and then applying different frameworks to certain things. But what made you start to really latch on to platforms? And when did that turn into, because that's also the foundation for your thesis of platforms, circular platforms as they come up. I mean, but that wasn't a natural progression to go from fracking to platform.
Exactly. So, you know, in the oil and gas space or power utilities, there aren't very many platforms, to be honest. But I was seeing a lot of activity outside of that space. And, you know, a lot of innovation or insights come when you take insights from one domain space and you bring it into a new domain space to see why it's working or can it work and things of that nature. And it was just around that time that there was this growing attention to the Internet of Things, right? If you recall, IoT, Industry 4.0. And so I became very involved in that and actually wrote the white paper that announced when GE came out and announced that they were going to become a digital industrial enterprise. So platforms became very important because what was happening at that time was the recognition that you could link things that you was hard to link in the past through the internet, the rise of obviously smartphones and connectivity, but also data. And so the industrial players recognized, wow, we have a lot of access to data. How do we turn that into something that can lead to new services, new productivity for the industry and things of that nature? So it was kind of harnessing that. And when you really dig into it, a lot of those things are enabled by these platform business models. So that's how I got into it. And I became really interested and have, you know, pursued that area for, I guess, about a decade and a half now.
Oh, I mean, put it bluntly, you're one of the thought leaders in the space, no question, right? You're sort of at the vanguard of the intelligentsia that's beginning to analyze platforms, has been analyzing platforms, putting data behind platforms, looking even at the evolutionary changes of platforms. And so that's going to kind of, there's a bridging question here insofar as you've watched platforms evolve over 15 years of this kind of macro view of them, right? Getting deeper into them, watching them kind of change in time, economic models haven't changed that much, but they've gotten better. There's no question. But what are the trends that you've noticed in their evolution? And that's a leading question into why circular platforms is all of a sudden now kind of hot topic. But it starts with platforms themselves and their evolution over the last 10 to 15 years from your perspective.
So I think one kind of lens to look at this through is at the very beginning, people recognized, wow, with connectivity, the internet, and the ability to exchange information and bring parties together, you could facilitate discovery, matching, and things of that nature. So the early days of platforms are very much around facilitating and improving the efficiency of transactions.
Okay.
So those were what we would call a shallow platform, right? They're just focused on that, which is a very important role that they play. But over the years, what we've seen is that you can layer in all sorts of additional services. And so I think one of the big changes that has taken place is that these linear platforms have built that foundation, and most of the early ones build it from scratch, right? And so they built their own tech stack. Now, platforms have become pretty prolific, and many companies want to pursue platform. So there is actually a software industry now that specializes in delivering specialized platform or marketplace software. So that's been interesting. So if you want to, if you've decided you want to go build a platform, you don't have to do it from the ground up. You can actually lean into these existing software companies. So that's an interesting phenomenon. But the other thing is that there's all these services that you can build into your platform. And we've seen this in Amazon as a great example, where it started as a transaction platform, but now it layers in all these other kinds of services like logistics, like insurance. You know, now when you buy an airplane ticket, you will often see a buy box that includes an insurance officer. So there's what they call embedded insurance now in the platform architecture. There's also communities that have built up around platforms. So that's another service, right, that is provided by the platform. So these platforms are getting deeper and deeper, and those actually generate new monetary streams, so new revenue streams for the platforms. And then you can add data. And so data becomes another value proposition. And what all of these things do is help facilitate what they call network effects, right? The more participants that join, the more value is created, which attracts more participants. So these value-added embedded services can begin to really create pretty rich and deep platforms. So we distinguish kind of, I think the evolution is interesting, and we've kind of moved from these kind of simple transaction platforms to very deep and rich service, you know, complex service delivery mechanisms.
And as you look at the tapestry, because again, this is sort of leading into now the circular effects that are starting to happen. We've had this linear economy, almost this linear supply chain. And the marketplaces, for lack of a better term, have been the digital twins of these offline things that existed before the internet. But they've essentially started to digitize the entire start to finish, manufacturing to delivery to logistics to, you know, receipt of the customer, but have yet to begin to embrace the circular side, which is the whole, you know, we're going to get into all that stuff. But in that, right, so where I'm kind of going with this is, You know, as you look back on that, even what you just described, and how would you then begin to connect the dots to this almost just very natural progression where, you know, these marketplaces have in effect, whether horizontally or vertically, begun to attach themselves to all facets of the linear economy. But now as they begin to turn circular, that's then forcing function for existing marketplaces to begin to embrace and or new marketplaces to enter, right?
You
kind of see that.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction, which is the vast majority of existing marketplaces are linear and they're all focused on linear transactions.
Right.
However, if you really dig around, you can find that they're actually specialty marketplaces that then pick up the transactions in what they do call close the loop.
Right.
Right. And so I would say the dominant right now feature is linear marketplaces. However, you have a growing number of specialized marketplaces that specializes in these circular transactions. And so one of the things that I've been trying to understand and focus on is there a difference between these? Mm-hmm. What role does a linear marketplace do that may be different from what a circular marketplace does? And so I'm starting to get some insights into what distinguishes these. And of course, you can have a marketplace that does the full thing. And we're beginning to see Amazon move into that. Mm-hmm. They have started, there's a service that they provide now called Amazon Refurbish, I believe, the name. Or is it Amazon Renew? I think it's Amazon Renew, and then eBay has Refurbish.
Okay.
I think it's proper distinction. And then there's a very large one in China called Idlefish, or Sanyu is Chinese. And so those are the biggest, but they're small relative to the linear transactions at these platforms.
Right.
But there's also a small but growing smattering of others. So you have marketplaces now for recycled metals.
Mm-hmm.
You have marketplaces for construction. You have marketplaces, circular marketplaces for furniture.
Mm-hmm.
You have them for plastics. You also have them for phones, smartphones. So I would say electronics, apparel, you also have them. And there's differences, right? You can have peer-to-peer marketplaces where you're facilitating exchange between parties, you know, one consumer with another consumer. And then you have cases where businesses are repurposing things and selling them directly back to customers as refurbished items. And then you have B2B exchanges where companies are exchanging materials. So there's quite a diversity because, frankly, the circular economy is pretty big and complex because you're talking about the whole kit and caboodle. And I think it's also important to distinguish it from the sharing economy, right? That was a big concept, especially with the rise of Uber and Airbnb, you know, and sharing assets. That was kind of an asset utilization insight and that they build a business model around. But the sharing economy is actually repurposing, fixing, repairing, or completely recycling and sending it all the way back through the supply chain. So it's actually much bigger and more complex than the sharing economy.
So now the title is The Rise of Circular Marketplaces. That's the report that you've authored that's out there and everyone can get it at MixAdden or whatever, and we can also show it as well. But this didn't just start with the paper that you just put together last couple of months. It has been a couple of years worth of work, right? And so I even want to kind of start, you've gone through a lot of it, but even in your own insights, as you begin to now kind of expose people to what seems like a natural evolution of marketplaces to become circular marketplaces, you know, what have you seen in the last couple of years to get you to this place that now you've got pretty good insight as to what it looks like it's going to need to happen, right? And that's going to lead us into kind of what is happening.
Yeah, sure. Well, first you have to kind of assess the landscape. And the way I do that is I build databases. And I start collecting examples to see what's out there. And one of the things that I found pretty interesting is just the scale and the scope. So this diversity across sectors. I just mentioned plastics, metals, electronics, apparel. So these marketplaces are present. They're, they tend to be small relative to the potential need. And we could go back to the the big drivers that are in place. So I think that there's evidence that circular marketplaces are there, they exist, and there are some of them are supported through public sector support, endorsement, and funding, but the vast majority of them are commercial operations.
Okay.
So we know that they're commercially viable, but what we need to see is we don't see them at the scale as potentially needed. So I think the business model, I think, has been proven. It can be adapted, and then basically borrowing the innovations that have happened in linear platforms and apply them to driving much more efficiency in transactions for circular, I think, is one thing that we're beginning to see. And there's some really interesting platforms out there that are adapting machine learning techniques, AI applications, even computer vision, to be able to detect repairs and also create what they call the metadata associated with various products, as well as tracing technology is really beginning to grow. And what you find is for a circular marketplace to really work well, it has to be incredibly data rich. It actually has to be more data rich than a linear marketplace. And the reason is that those products have already been used. And so you don't really know the quality of those products. So you actually need a grading system. So that's something that a circular marketplace has to have that a linear marketplace doesn't, which the customers need to know. Is this a grade A, grade B, grade C, grade D? And then that allows you to do pricing, right? So for linear marketplaces, those prices are done by manufacturers. And, you know, as you know, in big companies, you have pricing teams.
They
spend a lot of time of figuring out what the right price should be, but that's based on something that's standardized. It comes out of the factory, and of course they have some defects and those get chucked and thrown away, but it should be like 98% of them should be exactly the same. And so you should be able to price those at whatever the market can bear. And, you know, there's constantly changing and fluctuating debates on what to price them at. But anyway, it's totally different when you're dealing with something that's already been used, or you don't know how well that was used, where it was used. So there's a lot of information that buyers need to be to really be able to determine, is this a product that's going to work for me? And then on the seller side, you know, they need to provide more information. So anyway, these circular marketplaces need to be more information rich. The other is to being able to find this stuff.
Right.
So example is in a city, cities are material rich. And companies are constantly coming in and moving out. So, you know, one area is office furniture. It doesn't seem like that much, but when you aggregate all the cities in the world and all the office furniture and equipment that goes into running commercial building, it's phenomenal, right?
Right?
The size and scale. And what's happening is a lot of this stuff is ending up in landfills, not because it isn't good, is that they don't know where the buyers are.
Right.
And they can be in different industries, right? And so why would this one company know anything about another company in a totally different industry, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can imagine, you know, a manufacturer doesn't know what's going on in the insurance industry in terms
sure.
of office equipment.
Sure.
So if you can build a matching market that would connect these, and that gets into this question of, are these going to be single marketplaces in which all these transactions happen? Well, probably not. What you need to often do is do what Uber did, which is to create hyperlocal marketplaces. You have the common infrastructure and common branding and common interface, but the actual exchange happens at the local level. And so these platforms can help, and that's this embedded services mm-hmm. in creating a richer, deeper marketplace
mm-hmm.
where you include logistics support.
Mm-hmm.
You can include things of verification. You may even need that one company may be willing to buy that product, but they can't take it right now. They can take it 3 months.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to arrange storage for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another something that the platform could potentially help arrange. And that
right.
friction and transaction costs that are associated with. Now, for linear marketplaces, that's all handled by the warehouses and the distributors. They have a very well worked out system for how product gets to end customers in the linear marketplaces.
Mm-hmm.
On the circular side, you know, there's still work to be done to build out that infrastructure. But once it's built out, then you can reduce the cost and reduce the friction associated with doing linear transactions.
And so, again, building on that is also, I'm going to tee up a question that's come on the heels of this, which is the investment community, where I'll pivot over there for a second, because I think that's one of the key grease, you know, oils to the engine here to kind of get going, and whether they've been hesitant or not, or you're seeing more involvement there. But you've also laid out what appears to be, in a way, kind of like a product roadmap to some extent, right? Where if you're going to be a circular marketplace and taken seriously, you've got to have rich data and around the assets. Otherwise, you know, that there's a direct relationship between the accuracy of that data and the value you can extract from that good as it's moving through the circular marketplace. And it seems to me that the linear marketplace just stops at the consumer or the person who buys the good. And there's that gap that needs to be filled in with a Carfax digital twin record for the asset that continues into perpetuity as that asset is used over and over and over again until it's broken down to its piece parts again. That's just one thing, but I'm sure there's a few others that are in your head that you go, God, if this was, you know, if I could tell investors to go do these sorts of things, this would really kind of kickstart this a little bit faster.
Yeah. Well, you know, there's a combination of things that are,
yep,
that are driving this. One's changing consumer sentiment. So there's a recognition that even in Asia, which was very adverse to buying secondhand, now it's becoming more trendy.
Yep.
So there's the consumer sentiment side of the equation. There's also on the B2B side, you know, questions, you know, procurement officers and departments are given specifications that they must meet in order to make their procurement. And those, the question is, and but the systems that where they go buy are very geared towards buying new, which is part of the linear, right? Delivering linear. What's going to be interesting is when new variables come in that could change the equation. So, for example, typically reused products and goods typically have a lower carbon footprint. So, and they're cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question becomes, what kind of performance guarantees can you put behind them to make them sufficiently acceptable to meet the criteria for that? And so when you do a one-to-one comparison, you're saying, yeah, performance I can guarantee, but it's a lot cheaper and it has a much lower carbon footprint. That, you know, getting those systems, well, those systems are very, very nascent right now. But I think over the next 5 years, we're going to see the big procurement software companies.
Mm-hmm.
You can, SAP, for example, has a new product that they're rolling out called Encore, and it's going to allow for companies to potentially see used items as well as new items, very transparently. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, you know, what is your buying criteria? You know,
sure.
Are you just going for cost or is it carbon? And these circular marketplaces are embedding carbon accounting. So you're going to be able to very easily do your carbon reporting. And they're very definable versus doing a carbon offset with trees and, you know.
Yeah, right.
Someplace, very difficult to account for those. So I think people are going to wake up and recognize that that is a very valuable and interesting value proposition, that you can actually meet your ESG goals through changing how you do procurement.
Yeah.
And so that's very powerful. Another set of drivers that is worth considering are what they call extended producer responsibility laws.
Mm-hmm.
And these are growing. In the United States now, there are over 136 laws that have been passed that put more responsibility on the original manufacturer to take back those goods.
Okay.
Right. And so that's another driver. So you can imagine a world in which these companies are now trying to figure out and get saddled with taking this back. And this is a reaction to municipalities in general saying, listen, we don't want this stuff in our landfills anymore. You know, it's externalities management and who bears the risk and the cost of these externalities. And there's a lot of pushback now, and it's gaining traction in the United States, Europe, and in Asia, that we're producing a lot of stuff, and a lot of that stuff is ending up in the responsibility of municipalities, and they're just like, no more.
Right.
So what would be, I think, super exciting is if we can align extended producer responsibility laws with these circular marketplaces so that the manufacturers, when they increasingly become responsible for figuring out how to take back some of these equipment, they now have a circular marketplace that they can divert these to and get these products to their next highest use value.
Right, right. So that's a great segue into, because you also kind of outlined where I want to head with this, with the investor side of things, right? Which is, I don't want to leave that out of this. And kidding, again, starting at the beginning, if I look at the circularity gap report that just came out, which doesn't tell us a good story, you know, our circular numbers are getting worse, but it's only 6 years old, right? We've gone from 9% to 7%, you know, depending on how you analyze the data and whether that's directional or not, the trend is not going in the right direction. And then I go back in my own personal experience just in the space, you've seen it as well too, is, you know, the investment community, it's kind of on the sideline still, it seems like, right? Most of this, as you mentioned earlier, is corporate need, right? The necessity, the mother of all invention, right? Necessity is mother of all invention. Corporations need to take their stuff back, right? So you see programs being launched by IKEA, hell, Legos out there. I mean, you know, Mercedes obviously popularized the pre-owned Mercedes way back in the day. I know Cisco flipped completely when they changed CEOs to go and take everything back. In the electronics world, you're seeing a lot more take back. So it almost seems
Dell
like
has a program.
Oh, Dell has a program, right? All your electronics manufacturers certainly
so
do.
I call that going circular alone.
Okay.
So Patagonia is another example,
yep.
Right? North
yep.
Face, I believe, has programs. So that's going circular alone. And
yep.
You know, I think those are good programs. The question is can you scale those
right
to the level that we really need to drive a more circular global economy?
Right.
And I think they fall short on the scaling opportunity. And are they going to their highest use value in their second life?
Yep.
And then you have to, you know, question. So as they say, the outputs of one industry can be the inputs for another industry. So I think what the marketplaces can do is become that exchange where you can begin to connect. Hey, you know, this is the material that's there. Also, there's this problem of ownership. You know, the manufacturers sell this stuff. It's mm-hmm. owned by somebody else. It may change hands a couple times. And then what do you do with it there? And so you want to stimulate an efficient market to get this stuff to its next highest use value.
Mm-hmm. And so again, you've teed that up, though, and I want to kind of bullseye here a little bit on the investor side of this, right? So whether it's venture capital, private equity, or otherwise, corporations have been, through necessity, forced to kind of do this take-back thing. But to your point, that doing it on their own is never going to achieve scale, and it's never going to achieve the true circular marketplaces that the world needs to bend the curve from 7% to go up into the 10, 20, 30, 40% circular economy. That's going to require investors. And I know you've worked with them. You've seen Goldman Sachs issue a report recently that's new. So there's a trend that's starting to happen, but what else are you seeing in your, because you must also talk to these people.
Well, I've been tracking investments in circular marketplaces. So in 2023, there were about 25 companies that received funding for about $500 million. So close to $500 million.
Okay.
You know, so for any one of these particular companies, that's great. You know, it gives them some room. In last year, as we know, in the VC world, it was a tough year. So not as much money available. But when you look at the need or the scale, I think a lot more money potentially needs to be pumped into this space. Also, you know, it's interesting. There's a number of VCs that have labeled themselves or put out the proposition that they're focused on the circular economy. I don't see them investing so much in circular marketplaces.
Yeah.
The investors that have been investing in the circular marketplace is pretty diverse.
Yeah.
Some of them are just companies that have decided to invest in marketplaces. And so
okay.
Now adding circular. So I think there's what they call these impact investors.
Yep.
I think kind of more attention in to that community, to the power of platform business models. So mm-hmm. maybe a bit of education. And then, you know, these industries really pop when you see one superstar launch. So
yeah.
One of the things I looked at was, are there any unicorns? Are there
yeah.
any like circular marketplace unicorns? Well, it turns out that there are.
Okay.
Which is pretty exciting. And so, you know, I think that those stories of, yeah, you can actually make money in this space and it's not a charity,
mm-hmm.
that there are real investment opportunities. So Back Market in France, which focuses on and specializes in electronics, is you might call it green unicorn.
Okay.
A company called Carousel in Singapore is another one. This is a peer-to-peer marketplace for goods. So it's valued now at over $1 billion. Vestiaire Collective, another one out of France. This is focuses on luxury resale. Wallapop in Spain. StockX, you know, in the US is an interesting case. This is kind of the sneakerhead world, but they also do handbags and other collectibles. It's got a, you know, 2 billion plus valuation. And then Depop, which was acquired in Grover, is kind of a reuse and kind of rental platform. So there are a number of them out there. And I think telling that story that you can have green unicorns that are circular marketplaces, so the business model can work. So that can get other investors excited to look at kind of what's coming. And then we have regulatory drivers and consumer drivers that I think are promising. And, you know, the world is moving to 9 billion people. That's a lot of material that's produced every year. And also, you know, in some sectors, this issue of material, the critical materials has gotten attention of governments. So there's a national security component in some of these, like batteries for EVs, you know, consume lithium, cobalt, other materials that are scarce. And so there's a lot of interest in ensuring circularity. Now, what needs to be connected is it isn't just about building circular factory. I mean, recycling factories. It's also about creating the market environment that connects them efficiently, right? Because those, you know, take the case of EV batteries. Once they're sold into the market, they get distributed across the economy. They need a way to re-aggregate them efficient.
Yep. Right, right. So, okay. So a lot of things there, but already kind of, again, put a finer point on this. Sort of an infomercial to the VC PE crowd, right? Is you've effectively developed their investment thesis. And at the end of the day, it's just like, hey, you're even willing to share with them because that is a catalyst to investment in this critical area of circular marketplaces. You've done the homework to say, I've already picked out 8, if I've got the count right, basically circular marketplace unicorns. So it's not only possible, all the growth factors that are going into it, you know, that are driven by not only regulatory and consumer sentiment shifts, right? But there's a huge economic windfall that's waiting for people to get into this stuff. So, you know, I I'm sitting here going, geez, like, how is your stuff not required reading at these, you know, VCs and private equity firms that...
Well, you mentioned go ahead. Sachs. They have taken some of my research and put it in a research note recently. So some of them are paying attention. I would say, though, that we have to think about the spectrum.
Yep.
So one way to think about this is that you have high volume, low value items like plastics, right?
Okay.
Lots of volume, but very low value. So it's harder to build a marketplace in that space. And then on the other end of the spectrum, you have low volume, but very high value items like classic cars. And there's already a robust marketplace that's profitable in that space. What I think for the investor community that you're talking about is kind of in the middle, where you have high volume, maybe lower value, but still higher value than plastics.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a tremendous opportunity to suss out. And marketplaces do particularly well where there's a fragmented market, where the supply and the demand are both fragmented, and the marketplace helps aggregate both on the supply side, the demand side, to make those transactions. So from the investor standpoint, you would want to look at that sweet spot in the middle, and also where there's a high level of market fragmentation. And so that is a rich area for looking at marketplace business model opportunities for investment.
How about, because another one that you touched, that's almost a key linchpin, all this stuff really working, is the data side, right? So talk about digital twins a little bit, but unlock a little bit around the missing data and the opportunity there. Because that seems also, I don't know if marketplaces solve the data problem or they work with someone who creates the data and that gets put into them. How do you see that playing out?
Well, so I just had a demonstration from an extremely interesting marketplace called Excess Materials Exchange.
Okay.
And they're working with airports around the world. So airports are constantly being rebuilt. As you know, you go through an airport and it's like, when are they going to finish the construction? Well, when they take those things apart, the municipalities nearby don't want that stuff ending up in their landfills. So what they need to do is they need to tag the equipment, so or in the pieces. It can be steel, it can be all sorts of other types of items, so that they can be tagged and put on a marketplace so a buyer can potentially see it.
Okay.
Right. And so that tagging process is evolving. It's gotten much better than it was a decade ago with RFID. You have QR codes. There's a bunch of different approaches. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty exciting. And I see basically what I call enabling technology. So what are the technologies that enable marketplaces to do the things, the business model to do what it can do well? And so what's exciting and promising is that the data needs to be captured, right? And there's a lot of debate over social media, and what they're doing is capturing individual person's data, right? And there's a big controversy and lots of interesting policy discussions around how to regulate that properly. But on the material side, probably less concern about privacy, but it's more about how do you connect the device that captures that data and at what level, right? Mm-hmm. And so in Europe, you may be familiar with the work that they've been doing on the what they call the battery pass, which is essentially a set of rules that and protocols that determine where and how that data can be extracted from the battery. And at what level? Is it the entire battery pack, or is it at the cell level? Is it at the, you know, filament level? There's, you know, different grades. And the richer the data, obviously, the more value it provides for buyers to know what they're actually buying. The other value is it helps insurance companies know how to price the insurance offering.
Okay.
So the reason that you can get relatively low priced life insurance is there's a massive database on life expectancy.
Sure, right, right.
We don't have that massive database for all materials in the economy after they've left the manufacturer. And so the marketplace has become potentially very valuable, rich sources of generating that data, managing that data. And this would be a value proposition. So when I go back to that framework I shared of shallow versus deep, the marketplace has a strong incentive. The general marketplace, and this is why I think going circular alone, individual companies doing this just doesn't get it, because they don't create this rich, deep data that's necessary in order to facilitate these transactions.
Right. So, and again, I think you hit on something that was always key to my thesis around this space, which is the asset data, centralized asset data, and a repository where everyone can pull off of, because the more centralized and accurate that data is, that's the lubricant for the circular economy to really take off. Because if that was here today, like a Carfax is to a car, you'd kind of ease the concerns that most people would have, I would think, right?
Well, and also, you know, from a strategic perspective, you going back to your investor thesis, well, you want to start now, right?
Yeah.
Now, there's a relatively small market for end of life or kind of batteries that have been retired from vehicles is okay. Pretty small, but it's going to ramp up quite substantially. So there's obviously a first mover advantage of getting into this now on the ground floor, so that you're positioned to be able to serve that ramp up that's going to happen. And most people think that's going to happen post 2028, 29 period. However, there's a massive second mover disadvantage, because once the first mover comes in, they make relationships and bring on board the buyers and sellers onto their platform. It's really hard to knock them off and displace them once they've done that. There's also some interesting questions. You know, there's probably a national interest in having an efficient marketplace for batteries, because you can increase the rate of battery capture, which ensures that more material is going into back into the production of batteries. And so as we, you know, this goes to the great energy transition that we're under right now, which is we're moving away from a fossil fuel based economy to more of a renewable base. But these renewables require a different set of materials. But what's interesting about them is you don't just burn them and put them into the atmosphere. You use them and then you can recycle them, because a lot of them are metals based. Right. And there's been some really interesting analysis to show that you know, these batteries can be recycled over and over and over again because they're core materials, right? It's
right.
Process reconnecting them. That's why I think a marketplace makes a whole lot of sense in some of these big industries, batteries being one of them, but it also could be for solar panels.
Sure.
You know, because we now have a growing installed base of solar panels. They're not going to last forever. They're going to have to be replaced. And then that's going to lead to a large amount of material because these are material heavy assets, right?
Yep.
And there's a lot of specialty metals in them. So we need to reprocess those. And a marketplace could be a pretty interesting way to do that efficiently.
Sure, sure. And you've touched on a few of the sort of, we'll call it, I don't even want to call them verticals or components of the overall economy. Verticals, it's, you know, and we've talked a little bit about construction because, you know, construction reuse has another big driver that's coming up, which is the empty office space that needs to be repurposed. You know, in commercial space right now, on a global basis, that is a huge glut of inventory that needs to be rethought of from a repurposing. You touched on EV batteries because that's a driver behind just, you know, shelf life for these batteries is 7 to 8 years, I think is what I've seen or whatever. So it's not forever. And we're kind of coming through the first or second term of these EV batteries. That's going to continue to go on to perpetuity. Clothing you mentioned, because that's more of a trendy thing right now. People are kind of thinking about reuse and extending and all that sort of stuff. Where else do you see drivers at a macro level that are opportunistic now for circular marketplaces to jump in and really help facilitate?
Sure. So I think one that's in that sweet spot I mentioned is phones.
Okay.
Phones are now a multi-billion dollar market, secondary phones.
Right.
Right. I think the numbers are in, is it 1.5, maybe 2 billion phones are sold each year?
Yes.
And so there's a huge amount of phones, and typically the first users use them for 3 years and then they trade them in for a new phone. But those phones go into the secondary market. That secondary market right now is highly fragmented. So as I mentioned earlier, marketplaces do well when there's a fragmented supply and fragmented demand. And it's an interesting space. Insurance companies end up with a lot of phones because they guarantee them. And when the phone breaks, they end up with the phone. And a lot of telcos end up with phones.
Okay.
And so what they're looking for is a way to get their next highest use value. There's also a demand on the other side because there are people that can refurbish these, they can replace the batteries, and there's a grading system, but it's not standardized around the world. And another thing that's interesting is, you know, if you've been to Southeast Asia, you often see these little kiosks where somebody's selling some used phones. That person can't buy 5,000 phones in one go. They don't have the capital to do so.
Right.
And so the market right now is not set up well to serve them so well. But if you had a marketplace, they could go in and buy 50 phones or 25 phones, right?
Sure.
And so that was more aligned with their working capital capabilities to finance.
Right.
So anyway, marketplaces can do large volume, big scale transactions as well as these smaller transactions. And so that's the pretty cool thing about marketplaces is that they can scale with the size of the orders, and they also can bundle orders.
Mm-hmm.
So an interesting case is... If let's say a car dealer, how many returns do they get a month? Maybe 20 cars that get returned for somebody who wants to buy a new car, so a trade-in market. But let's say a recycler wants 5,000 batteries a month.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they have to go from dealer to dealer to dealer to aggregate that order. So the marketplace can do that. They just put in an order and say, we want 5,000. The machine learning algorithm can go through and see who has these batteries. And then the platform can also help you manage the logistics to determine how far away they are and then optimize your order so that it meets your specification at the lowest cost.
Totally. So let me shift now ever so slightly forward looking, right? Because now you've just, you know, we've talked kind of the genesis of where you came from. We talked a little bit about platforms, how that's evolved to circular platforms. You basically created an investment thesis that all investors should be following. But again, that's my infomercial for you. if anyone picks it up, that's a different conversation. But you've laid it out, like where they should invest, how they should invest, what they should be looking for, even the metrics they can hold those companies against, I think you've created through your reporting. Looking out for this year, though, you know, we're still at this sort of early stages, right? I mean, it's just shocking to me when even thinking about it for 10 years that we're still in the early stages of circular and circular marketplaces coming to fruition. What are you doing with this report now that it's authored over this first half and second half of the year, whether it's you or McFadden or whatever, to kind of promote and continue to kind of sound the horn that this is coming, whether people like it or not? Question maybe is a little bit about timing. You know, how do you help speed that up with your efforts this year?
As I mentioned, one of the areas that I'm doubling down on is really understanding the software architecture to support marketplaces. And it's a combination of, you know, there are not that many vendors. As I mentioned, they're largely focused on linear marketplaces. Yep. And so understanding who has the capability to shift to circular capabilities.
Yep.
So that's one. The other is to understand these enabling technologies, like the tracing technology that can be brought in and embedded. Also looking hard at the insurance, because you need those guarantees in order to build, you know, confidence and peace of mind on the buyer side. So the insurance industry is quite interesting as a kind of a player in these marketplaces, and they can benefit from it as a new sales channel for their offerings. So interested in building, you know, these circular marketplaces. So been participating in a new initiative that the National Retail Federation has just launched. They've just announced a new sustainability institute.
Okay.
And they just had a working meeting in New York City as part of the big show at NRF. And so that was really exciting. I got to meet some new brands. They serve retail brands. And so that was a pretty interesting engagement. And I'm excited about what their agenda is going to be. Also working with the United Nations in Europe and the UNECE, they've launched a work stream in this area and are digging into some of the policy issues associated with kind of, there's two sides. One are the barriers and how do you remove those barriers? And on the other side, what kind of government support needs to come in to help facilitate and launch? A third area is right now writing a grant application to the Department of Energy to do a detailed feasibility study of a circular marketplace for North America for batteries, EV batteries.
Wow.
So doing that and then talking to companies that are interested in launching circular marketplaces or companies that want to build this into their supply chain strategy, right?
Right. And with that then, isn't the your platform summit at MIT coming up last year had a huge focus on circularity.
That was me.
Well, that was you. Of course it was. But does that continue? Do you see that continuing? Because it sounds like you're getting quite a bit of attention from other international standards bodies, both, I mean, locally, domestically, whatever you want to call it, internationally, but also the work through MIT and, you know, that Platform Institute that also is adopting a lot of circular stuff and kind of messaging and even authoring certain things, I'm assuming, in, you know, whatever students are there studying.
Yeah, well, I think that, you know, MIT is in a rich, very dynamic and challenging place to explore big problems. And it's been, an honor and, an incredible career opportunity to co-chair that conference. And it also helps when you need to put the panel together and people are like, well, where do you want me to speak? And you say MIT. Okay.
Yeah, right, right.
It's easier to get speakers when you're putting something together. So, I'd like to continue on this theme. And last year was kind of an exploration, but it was pretty interesting, as I believe you attended as well.
Yep.
So you got to see that we had the Ellen MacArthur Foundation there. We also had a new platform from the Middle East called Rebound, which is focused on plastics, which is pretty exciting and interesting. And so, the MIT is an opportunity to introduce people to these platform concepts, but it's also a way to bring people who have domain expertise. And as I try to explain, is that there are circular marketplaces out there, and there's some really interesting and rich experience that we can bring to this. And kind of my ambition has been to bring the platform world together, or the platform economy folks together with the circular economy folks, and see where there are really important synergies and benefits of cross-learning.
Yep, yep. And just to kind of wind down and close out that sort of prognostic view, right? How do you see, I mean, here we are in 2024. A lot of people call this the decade of the supply chain, which is really driven by this circular kind of concepts. How do you see this playing out? I mean, 6 years into a circular gap report, we've gone in a different direction. I mean, do you see these next couple of years still as this early kind of bumpy adoption phase? And by 2030, circular marketplaces are much more common. What's sort of your view on that?
A couple ways to answer that. One is that if we are going to grow the circular economy, which is relatively small today, and really scale it, I think that there's a very big role for marketplaces to play, right? They're just more efficient economically. There's just great technology behind them. And so let's apply this business model to this problem.
Yep.
And so right now, when we look at the circular economy, it's estimated to be around $400 billion, which is pretty small relative to the size and scale of the global economy. And one of the reasons the circularity gap report indicates that only, 7% of materials are reused?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we need to grow that number. Right now, I estimate that about 25% of the current circular economy is driven by circular marketplaces.
Got it.
Okay, about 25%. So the question is like, as we look out and we see the circular economy growing, what share will these marketplaces make up of the circular economy? And I think they're going to make up a growing share. In fact, it may be the fastest growing share.
Sure.
Right? Because they're just very powerful reasons, just like we saw in the linear economy. I mean, Airbnb now is in over 200 countries around the world. I mean, that thing just took fire and scaled tremendously. So I'd love to see the same scaling effects happen in the circular economy, leveraging the power of marketplaces.
Sure, sure. Got it. Well, that's a really good point to sort of wind down. So, you know, again, hour comes and goes faster than you realize. I'm sitting here looking at the clock going, oh my God, I could go for another 2 hours. Clearly, there's a bunch going on, but people can find you, you know, on LinkedIn. Obviously, open to networking there, obviously at McFadden. And what are sort of the usual shout outs to where we can find you and what you're up to?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a big fan of LinkedIn. I don't know if you've seen, but LinkedIn has now crossed 1 billion participants.
There's a platform for you.
Oh, it's a big platform. When I joined, I think there were like maybe 20 million or something. Mm-hmm. Now we're at 1 billion.
Yeah.
So yes, LinkedIn is my preferred platform for engaging. And I try to post almost every week on this topic. I actually just did a post on ABB, which is a big, you know, company that does a lot in the energy space, and pretty exciting. They just did a circularity challenge. They had 100 startups apply and pick 3. And then they also just released a report on why we need to go circular. So, I mean, it shows you that companies are starting to pay attention to the space. I don't think they don't have it all figured out as to how to do it well. So.
Sure.
That's what we're trying to figure out, is how to help them understand what the landscape is and make good bets in this space.
Awesome. Well, listen, Peter, again, apologies for not having you on sooner. It's shocking that we haven't done this before, but great to have you here. Really wonderful episode. Really appreciate your time.
Appreciate it. And I'll be back anytime you invite me. So thank you so much.
Glad to have anytime. All right. Well, thanks so much.